and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off this week. I'm your host this week, Becky Friedman, and I got with me in the studio two awesome folks, Dan and Josh. Dan, it's been a little while since we've had you in the studio. How's 2019 treating you so far?
So far, 2019 has treated us pretty well, so we're doing great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And Josh, how you doing?
I'm a little nervous.
Nervous for 2019?
No, well, I feel like I've kind of got to do something about my weight problem, so I'm starting a new diet.
Oh, are you? This is in the sort of New Year's resolutions vein, or?
Yeah, I don't like doing New Year's resolutions because they never work, but my hero, Chris Pratt, he's a Pacific Northwesterner hero, and he's doing this fantastic sounding diet where he fasts for 21 days, and so I'm going to follow suit.
My skeptic bells are ringing. Josh.
I strongly recommend against long periods of fasting as a part of a diet.
But it's from the Bible.
What?
It's got to be good, right?
It changes everything. Yeah, it's fine. No.
All I have to do is drink water and eat seeded foods, and I'm good for 21 days. And after that, you know, it's all golden. So, I mean, what can go wrong?
You might be great, but your lower GI tract might not.
What is a seeded fruit?
It's seeded food. So basically, for 21 days, I'm only allowed to eat foods with seeds in them and water. So, you know, kind of like a fructarian diet that Steve Jobs did. And that turned out pretty well, right?
Oh yeah.
So, I mean.
So, Chris Pratt, hold on a sec. Chris Pratt is your hero. He's from the Pacific Northwest?
Yes, I believe he's actually from the Kenmore area, if I remember correctly, or Issaquah.
So, hunky action hero for, you know, lots of movies.
We're talking Star-Lord,
like
right?
Yeah, okay. Star-Lord, okay. Absolutely. Right. I mean, come on, see the abs on that guy?
And the voice of the protagonist in the Lego movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Everything is awesome. I hope I don't get sued for that.
Something along this diet seems that there's something here that is not awesome. This is a biblical-based diet that he thinks is going to... I mean, I guess people look for different ways to improve their bodies and selves from all different sources.
Yeah, what better source than the Bible? I mean, come on.
I can think of a ton of better sources than the Bible. I mean, the Bible tells us that that bats are birds and that insects have four legs.
Bats fly, right? They're birds. I mean, come on.
Airplanes, birds. Dragonflies, birds. Helicopters, birds. Paper airplanes, birds.
We name airplanes after birds, so booyah.
Josh, you're really worrying me here.
You mean like falcons and eagles and hornets?
Well, osprey and...
Oh, yeah.
So, Josh, please tell us here that you are not abandoning your atheistic principles and abiding by a biblical diet here.
Absolutely not. This sounds terrible. And Chris Pratt, if you ever listen to this, please don't do this.
This is a great way to... segue into fat-soluble toxins. Can we talk about that a little bit?
What do you mean by fat-soluble toxins in this point? I thought toxins were all a bunch of woo. I mean, we had Ask an Atheist. We've taken a skeptical eye towards a lot of these, like, diets and cleanses and fads and things like that. And we've really, I mean, we've raked folks over the coals for saying, I'm going to cleanse myself of all of the toxins. Because it seems like toxins is about as meaningful as saying quantum.
It basically is. In scientific terminology, quantum has a specific meaning, and it's not the Deepak Chopra meaning. Vibrations have a specific meaning. Crystals have specific meanings. And toxins also have specific meanings in the scientific vernacular, regardless of how that vernacular is co-opted or exploited by New Age woo or any kind of related stuff. But to be clear... fat-soluble toxins, things like mercury, things like polychlorinated biphenyls.
Oh, just those things, right?
Right. Polybrominated esters, things like that are things that build up in your fat and they stay there for a very long time. Well, there's kind of a nice thing about that. Once they're sequestered in your fat, they're out of your bloodstream, they're out of your metabolism, provided that you... still sort of maintain that fat. And I'm not
saying
so
this
that,
little spare tire here that I've got at the top of my jeans, like that's actually protecting me and my organs?
Sort of. Like I don't want to get into this idea where it's like, oh yeah, I'm telling everybody to go out and have a beer belly. I'm not. I'm saying that if you're trying to lose weight, fasting is a bad way to do that. That is a way to get all of those persistent bioaccumulative toxins right into your bloodstream. Once your body is done getting the energy it can from your muscles, bones, and internal organs, because that energy is more readily available than your fat, So once you've already experienced the state of bone degeneration, muscle degeneration consistent with starvation, as you would in a fasting diet, eventually your body's going to get to the fat and start breaking that down. And this is a state that we call ketosis. It's incredibly hard on your liver, on your kidneys, on your heart, on your entire circulatory system. It is not good for you to be in a state of ketosis. And when someone is in a state of ketosis, you can usually smell them a mile away. They reek. And the reason they reek is from everything that was locked up in their fat that is now being burned in their body, exuded through their skin, and circulating through their bloodstream. So
sounds kind of nasty.
If you want to get all of those persistent bioaccumulative toxins into your bloodstream all at once, then yeah, rapid weight loss is a great idea if you want to go on a fasting diet, or you know, do the extreme boot camp style, or I'm not going to say any specific names because I don't want to get sued, but any of those, like, you know, can you do this? Do you have the determination and the power to do this? And insane muscle rending workouts. That's a great way to turn your whole bloodstream toxic. If you're actually just trying to lose weight and get a little bit trimmer, you sort of want to do that slowly. It's not healthy to have a whole lot of weight loss all at once for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is persistent bioaccumulative toxins.
So, Chris Pratt, please, please, we don't want you to smell. We don't want you to reek.
Yeah.
Reconsider your biblical diet here. Josh, please reconsider abiding by Chris Pratt's, form, and find some other nicer way to get abs.
But the Bible.
So if we go and bring our heads out of the Bible for a moment and into the ocean, because Dan, it's been a while since you've been on the show, but somehow we always end up in the ocean when you're on. We've actually got some really fun and cool news. What potentially cool news about our local whale population, our local orca population, because researchers have confirmed that an orca calf has been born to one of the Salish Sea resident killer whales named L77. The baby, who is estimated to be several weeks old, is designated L124 and has been nicknamed Lucky. J, K, and L pods have actually not successfully bred in 3 years, and their numbers are dwindling as whales succumb to starvation. In July, an orca known as Tahlequah, Tahlequah, birthed a calf that only lived for half an hour, and she gained worldwide attention for carrying her dead baby for over 2 weeks over thousands of miles. Although conservation scientists cautioned that Lucky's survival is precarious, they report that the calf appears to be healthy.
That's all pretty good news. The female in question here, the mother, L77, her nickname is Maisha. She's about 32 years old, and she has had two calves before. Her first calf was born in 2010 and only lived a short time. That's actually really common in the southern resident killer whale population. Most of the firstborn calves will die, and they will die of, well, tying into our last bit here, toxicity from persistent bioaccumulative toxins.
Why would a first baby be so so at risk of this sort of toxic buildup?
Because they don't have access to a juice cleanse.
So females build up these fat-soluble toxins in their fat, but when they have a calf, they begin converting that fat into milk for their child. That milk contains all of those fat-soluble toxins, and so females sort of dump their early accumulation of these toxins right into their firstborn's mouth. The firstborn will almost always die of toxicity in this population of orcas. And the reasons for that have to do with industrial runoff, mercury from burning fuels, all the sort of impurities that you'll find in diesel fuel, that you'll find in coal, that you'll find in bunker fuel from our maritime industry. A lot of persistent bioaccumulative toxins are used in the manufacture of ships and airplanes, two of the big things that happen here in the Northwest and have been happening for almost 100 years now. So we have some pretty nasty waters here. There's a lot of toxicity. But L77 here, as we said, has had two calves previously, one in 2010 and one in 2012. The one born in 2012 has survived so far. That orca's name is Joy. And looks pretty healthy as a six-year-old. It has been 6 years since the last calf, so there's no doubt some extra buildup of persistent bioaccumulative toxins in L77 Maisha's body. that she may then transfer over to this new calf that is sort of tentatively nicknamed Lucky. They usually hesitate to give them an official name until they've been around for a year or two. But if L124 survives, then that's going to be great news for this population. As you said, they haven't had a successful birth in 3 years.
And we've talked extensively with you, Dan, on this show about our resident orca population in the Salish Seas. What number are we at right about now? This calf makes, what, 70?
75.
75, okay. Yeah.
Which, you know, at the beginning of our sailing season, for those who don't know, I run a field trip called Marine Science Afloat for local schools here. We go out on a boat and kids learn about marine science and we have divers in the water. It's a great experience, but I didn't come here to pitch it. Anyway, we talk about orcas during the day. And, you know, at the start of our sailing season in March last year, I got to tell the kids that there were 77 orcas, and then it was 76, and then it was 75, and then it was 74 by this fall. So it's great that hopefully at the start of our sailing season this coming March, I can tell them once again it's 75 and maybe the numbers will be on the rise. We hope.
So as a humanist myself, as something we talk about, you know, on the show on Ask an Atheist, a lot of times we get questions or we get criticism saying, you know what, if you're a humanist, then you only care about humans and you don't really care about all of the other creatures. That's why I don't identify as a humanist. We've got that before. I don't know. Have you guys ever seen that?
Definitely. I've heard those call-ins and emails, certainly.
So how would, for you, Dan, how would your dedication towards orca conservation or just general conservation of the environment and different habitats really tie in with being a humanist?
That's sort of an ecological question. We have an energy exchange with the world around us. Every human being does. We have to take sugars and proteins and fats and water and oxygen out of the environment around us, and we return things to it. We return nutrients. We return carbon dioxide. But that's the thing about ecology. You can think of it sort of like a spider web, and if you pull one string, you don't really know what's going to happen to the rest of the web. We've had some very surprising effects happen, from killing off one creature that we thought was a pest or bringing in other creatures to control that pest. So personally, I'm not really into messing up ecology very much, especially when you're talking about interfering with an apex predator. I feel like we might be segueing into some more whale stuff.
Oh, you want to talk about a few other whale things?
Oh, most certainly.
Because, let's see, far away from the Pacific Northwest, Japan is actually pushing back on criticism of its commercial whaling restart. In December, Japan announced that it was withdrawing from an international agreement that allowed commercial sale of whale meat obtained through harvest of the animals for scientific research purposes. The International Whaling Commission had established a moratorium on whale hunts in 1986, but Japan's Antarctic minke whale hunts were conducted as an exception. The country has committed to pull out of Antarctic whaling and focus solely on whaling in its so-called economic zone. Foreign Minister Press Secretary Takashi Osuga argued that Japan sets strict catch limits based on scientific methodology to ensure the sustainability of whale stocks, and noted that Japan will fully comply with international law. So instead of just saying we're going to look at trapping and killing whales for scientific purposes, which then allows us to sell off this whale meat at a very high rate for exclusive cultural practice of eating whale meat for very, you know, rich individuals, we're just going to go all in and say, you know what, we're not even going to look at it for scientific purposes. It's strictly commercial, so we can feed all of our rich people this luxury novelty meat.
Right.
What do you make of this? I mean, from a conservationist perspective and a humanistic perspective.
From a conservationist perspective, I would say it falls back under the messing around with apex predators. Minke whales are filter feeders, but we're also talking about Breedy's whales and Sei whales as well, both endangered populations. Minkes are not so much endangered. They're fairly abundant, but they're not yet to what we call pre-industrial levels. And then part of the idea of the Whaling Commission is to get whale populations back up to pre-industrial levels before figuring out a sustainable whaling plan. The idea was to restore the populations and then possibly eventually begin hunting when the commission was founded. The problem is, when you have a population that's already too small, that isn't being hunted, and it has a number of other factors facing it, from climate change to a human overharvest of their prey, of krill and other small fish. They're still in a vulnerable position. Japanese whaling has always been sort of under the guise of research. As a person who likes to read published journal articles on whales, I haven't come across a whole lot of journal articles coming out of there. So, you know, I'm not gonna cry foul being a person who isn't from there and isn't, you know, 100% familiar with whaling culture or its significance in Japan. But I can tell you that if they are doing research, they're not really publishing it. And when pressed on this topic, they usually say that, you know, we're looking at their ages and their weights. Well, we've known for about 200 years about how big a Breede's whale, a Sei whale, or a Minke whale can get. And we've estimated about how long they can live, and that seems to be consistent. I'm not sure what you could possibly glean from doing more scientific whaling at this point. We know what they eat. We know how big they get. We know how long they live. What else are they looking for? Right back into persistent bioaccumulative toxins. When we look at large marine mammals, like these whales that are being served up as food, we find the highest concentrations of polychlorinated biophenyl, of mercury, of things that you absolutely do not want to eat. You find the highest concentrations in great whales of any living animal. This is significant. This is not only are they hunting a population that is already in trouble, but then they're taking this meat, this poisoned meat that is part of the reason that the whales are in this trouble, and selling it to people as if it's good to eat, as if it's healthy. I can only compare this to, like, yeah, if I decided to do an oil change on my car and then put it in a milk carton and sell it in the grocery store, this is not safe food. This is not safe for you. This is not safe for your children. This is not something you want to eat.
So some strong feelings there. Yeah. It's really interesting when we talk about populations of animals, not just for their impact on us as humans, but also as individual populations worthy of conservation, worthy of looking at as unique individuals or communities of unique individuals. I know we've talked a lot about the orcas here, but that kind of sort of culture within those great whale populations persists and is you know, worthy of study for many humanists and for many individuals around the world in general. I mean, we're not just looking at, you know, a bunch of automaton animals that don't have their individual, you know, like traditions or sets of behaviors and community and family, you know, ties and things
right,
like that.
Yeah, we're looking at the largest brains on planet Earth that are capable of having regional dialects, of having specific community traditions that are not carried out by other communities of the same species. In my mind, that says people. I don't really hesitate at all to extend the moniker of non-human person to cetaceans, to great apes.
Well, yeah, they also show empathy, because we had the mother whale dragging her baby whale for 2 weeks. I mean, that's the undeniable empathy.
Right.
Empathy, mourning, all of those things that really can be, you know, special, and we think that are unique to human populations, but really are much different. If you've got opinions on whales and the personhood of non-human animals, go ahead and tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA or give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. You're listening to Ask an Atheist, and we'll be back after the break.
This episode is sponsored by Cephalopod.
Hey, my little fishies, it's Jusubu89. Today I'm here with Donut Reviews, a work I'm going to be reviewing squid ink patches. They're said to cure common colds.
I hear they can even cure squiditis.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this. So you grab the patches. Oh, well, they're kind of slimy.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, but cool at the same time.
And then you stick them on right about here.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay, on the count of three.
One, two, three.
Oh,
use squid ink products. Despite their seemingly magical benefits, those claims are flimsy. They conduct their business in a shady manner, and we believe that Seth Olapod is dealing on the black market. You may even turn into a tentacle monster. Beware.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. You know, I've got an email here from Robert from the internet, and he says, I've been meaning to say I love the squid ink and anti-squid ink spots that you've been running. Made by the kids at Camp Quest, I'm guessing? Well, Robert, I hope you caught last week's episode. You can find all past episodes at atheist.radio. But yeah, Sam and Mike from camp definitely dug into a little bit and revealed the big mystery behind the squid ink conspiracy, or anti-conspiracy as it may be. And Dan and Josh, you were also at camp in 2018 and had a lot of involvement in either trying to convince or unconvince kids that squid ink had magical powers instead of our snake oil, right?
Yeah, that's right. That was a lot of fun to see the signals going off in the kids.
I think my favorite ones were the ones who decided to join in on the con.
To lean into
it. Like, oh yeah, this is all complete nonsense, but I want to see if I can make anybody else believe it.
It really gets behind that issue of propaganda, or how things are portrayed through media, or just person-to-person argumentation, to say, what can I actually believe and what can I not actually believe? Mm. Now tell me, is there bioaccumulation of toxins in squid ink?
Well, that's an interesting question, and boy, did you ask the right guy. Squid are actually very short-lived, so while there are very active, voracious predators, they usually don't live very long, and they're not a very fatty animal, so they don't have a lot of places to accumulate bioaccumulative toxins, and they don't have a lot of time to do it in. Even the largest known species of squid, the Maratuthis robustus, so-called the colossal squid that lives in Antarctic waters, is only estimated to live to about 3 years old.
So way less than some of these whales that are in that area that we were just talking about last segment. Right.
Many species of whale are known to live over 100 years. It's suspected that bowhead whales you find in the Arctic could live to be more than 200 years old.
How big does a colossal squid get?
They get to be about 1,000 pounds, but only 23 feet long.
Feet long.
In 3 years?
In 3 years, yeah. Tremendously voracious predators.
Wow.
They have to eat. Yeah, the previously thought the largest squid was the giant squid, Architeuthis ducks. You'll find all kinds of books that say they grow to 60 feet, but there's no actual historical record of anyone ever finding one at that size. The largest known was about 39 feet, and even that estimate is considered dubious because the feeding tentacles, their two long feeding tentacles, are very stretchy, and they think that perhaps that squid was stretched a little bit extra for the measurement.
Got it. Okay. Really trying to say, oh, I've got the longest squid ever. So, we also hear sometimes that things like squid and octopus can be very intelligent animals. You know, they don't seem to have brains a lot like humans or like whales, right? Like mammals that we were talking about. What's your call on sort of the personhood of something like an octopus or a squid?
Well, it's interesting. There is sort of changing ideas about this right now. IACUC regulations, which is the Institutional Animal Care and Usage something coalition. I can't remember what the last C is for. Anyway, they regulate how you treat animals used in research at universities and medical research. They have extended vertebrate protections to cephalopods as of last year, I believe. So,
okay,
if you
vertebrate
are keeping,
means that you're...
that you have a spine.
Okay.
As far as research on invertebrates goes, if you're looking at slugs, if you're looking at insects, things like that, you don't have to anesthetize them. You don't have to provide them proper care and housing, their regular diet, that kind of thing. You can sort of treat them however you want to. But vertebrates, you have to treat a little bit better. For whatever reason, they're considered to be more sentient. So if you're going to, say, dissect one, you have to anesthetize it at least first. With cephalopods, I believe it's been extended to enrichment as well. So they have to be given a natural diet. They have to be given a good habitat. They have to be anesthetized before anything invasive is done to them. And they have to be provided enrichment, the ability to solve puzzles, novel food sources, things like that, to sort of keep them entertained.
You know, I was watching the Nemo series, right? You got Finding Nemo, and then you got
Finding Dory.
Yeah, Finding Dory, and an octopus really features very prominently in mm-hmm. that as someone who is very wily and escapes very easily. And I was really fascinated to find out that, you know, looking a little bit more, the octopus featured in there is totally known for doing all sorts of escape antics.
Oh, yes.
Solving puzzles, doing all kinds of weird things like that. So we're not just talking about anthropomorphizing creatures for the purposes of Disney movies. These are actual, you know, intelligent, you know, one could say creatures.
Right. These are traits that are known to them. It's not much of an exaggeration. Their brain is very different from ours. They have a nervous ganglia, a bundle of nerves that's sort of central and wraps around their esophagus. Literally, if they swallow something, it has to pass through their brain, through a hole in their donut-shaped brain. But a lot of their nerves and other small ganglia are sort of spread out around their body. And so it's kind of hard to tell, you know, where the sentience resides. In humans, it's invertebrates, it's always sort of assumed that our sentience resides in our brain, behind our eyes kind of thing. But with them, it's really hard to tell. In fact, if you sever a tentacle from an octopus, that tentacle will not only continue to move, but it will continue to attempt to camouflage itself.
Ooh.
Even though the eyes are no longer connected to it. So there's kind of some weird stuff going on in cephalopods.
Kind of interesting things, and makes one think about what do we consider to be a sentient creature worthy of protection. You know, you'd think that most humans would have gotten past the all other humans are worthy of protection as individual autonomous sentient creatures. But I'm going to take us down to South America for a little tour there, where we have a leader who doesn't seem to be, you know, actually on that same page with us. Because on January 2nd, Brazil inaugurated the far-right, anti-gay, zealously Christian, misogynist, pro-fascist president, Jair Bolsonaro, who promptly transferred responsibilities for overseeing indigenous territories from the Justice Ministry to the Ministry of Agriculture, threatening the independence and resources of indigenous peoples and slave descendants in favor of agribusiness and Christianization of all Brazilians. Bolsonaro met with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to plan unified efforts against leftist governments in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Pompeo also revealed that Donald Trump is very pleased with the relationship that our two countries are on the precipice of beginning to develop, and that the two leaders believe in advancing a set of shared values. Help me out with this one, because it makes me want to smash my head through a computer monitor.
Yeah, we've already talked about Bolsonaro once before, and this is not good. I mean, we're talking about the fifth largest economy in the world. We're talking about a very important country within world standing. And we're also talking about a world that controls 25% of the world's carbon sink in the Amazon rainforest. And Bolsonaro is he wants to abuse that as much as possible as a resource.
Right. I understand that he's tied together not only with the forestry industry, but especially the beef industry, which is one of the most notorious destroyers of rainforest. They slash and burn rainforest to create grazing lands.
Yeah. And then we go into the indigenous populations of the Amazon rainforest that aren't even seen as legal persons in the eyes of Bolsonaro. We're looking at a possible genocide, and more than possible genocide.
To have this articulated that Donald Trump is really, really psyched to have this shared set of values here, you know, it's kind of a strange thing to think about, because we as observers can see that in the United States, the evangelical right that is really championing Trump is somehow, you know, it's a very strange thing, because we can all see that Trump does not seem to abide by any kind of, you know, strict Christian values. He's pro-divorce. He doesn't really, you know, give a darn about what happens with regards to abortion unless it sways his political favor. To him, it's all about ratings. So the shared set of values, I'm looking at Bolsonaro, who says that, you know, he thinks that, you know, we need to unite as Brazilians under, you know, Christian leadership, and said, you know, if you're indigenous, if you're animist, if you abide by Afro-Brazilian traditions, then you are not truly Brazilian. And so I'm looking at when Donald Trump said these are shared values. What is Trump looking at doing for the United States? Does he see that his ratings are so inflated by evangelical Christians that he's willing to say that Muslim Americans, that atheist Americans, that Jewish Americans aren't true Americans, just as Bolsonaro is doing to the indigenous people or the Afro-Brazilian communities in Brazil, to say you're not true Brazilians unless you worship Christ?
Trump really likes the swagger of dictators. I mean, he's shown this time and time again. It's not just Bolsonaro, but we're talking about Duterte, we're talking about Erdogan, we're talking about all these
not Little Rocket Man.
And Little Rocket Man when he's not on his bad side, when he's not trying to sit there and pretend to be tough. But he really appreciates these strong quotation leaders, basically people that are willing to kill for their ideology.
And we look at how these strong leaders gained their strength. We touched a little bit on this when Bolsonaro was actually elected at the end of last year. It's frightening. You know, you had someone that had what some might say the good foresight to try and actually assassinate him as a candidate. And some also might observe that, you know, his opponents decided to back off a little bit for fear of not wanting to be seen as totally digging into someone who was just the target of an assassination attempt. You know, let him go a little bit for a few weeks and not really dig into to the guy's, awful things that he's espousing by saying, oh, we hope for his swift recovery. Well, he swiftly recovered, both physically and politically, from his attempted assassination, his stabbing. He won his election. And to say that he's, anti-indigenous people, to say that he's merely misogynistic, to say that he's merely zealotous Christian, really, underplays the extent to which he has denigrated people, to which that he has just thrown so many individuals under the bus. And things that I would not even feel comfortable repeating on air that he has said about justifying sexual assault of women. And it makes me think, are those the shared values that Donald Trump is really seeing and chumming up with Bolsonaro? Or is it really the religious stuff? I mean, where did these two guys get off on saying that, oh, yeah, we're sort of similar? Is it just the dictatorship, or is it this disregard for people that are not like you, that are not of your religion or of your particular economic class or of your economic interests or of your gender?
I would say it's yes to all. I mean, we know that Trump really isn't a Christian, but he finds them very useful. So as his base, because that is the evangelical right is his base. And they won't leave him because they know that at least even if he doesn't go by their beliefs, he'll defend them. And he's done so with two Supreme Court picks that are devastating to human rights.
You know, speaking of human rights, when we look at this transfer of power that Bolsonaro has done, of looking at the independent autonomous regions within the Amazon and of the, minority populations in Brazil, transferring that from the Justice Ministry to the Ministry of Agriculture. It's just saying, all right, I'm going to take it out of a place of justice, a place of human rights, a place of looking at fairness for all people, and just give it to agribusiness, because I'm going to stack the Ministry of Agriculture with a bunch of, beef industry folks or, anti-forestry, lumber folks and things like that. But it's not just that he's gutting and then stacking with other folks that are more aligned with his ideals, because his new minister of human rights has stated that while the country is officially secular, that she herself is terribly Christian.
Wait, what? Like, that seems like a self-admission of something.
Yeah.
Can we just put that in quotation marks?
Terribly Christian.
Oh, it is. It is a quote from her. I am terribly Christian.
Christian.
Yes.
I mean,
operative underscore on terribly, right? So here's the thing. With the inauguration of Bolsonaro, all issues related to LGBT concerns have been excised from government involvement. Whereas the prior administration had actually designated the Human Rights Ministry with responsibilities for ensuring equality for this demographic. Human Rights Minister and evangelical pastor Damaris Alves is known for alarmist rhetoric that the traditional Brazilian family was under threat from governmental diversity policies, and asserted in her first speech as minister that under Bolsonaro, girls will be princesses and boys will be princes. There will be no more ideological indoctrination of children and teenagers in Brazil.
This all sounds very familiar.
This sounds like ideological indoctrination of children and teenagers in Brazil.
Yeah. The one hope that I have is, you know, Brazil has a lot of technology infrastructure that I don't think can be taken away just by the installation of this particular, you know, fascist happy misogynist, right? Or any one that he slates in his commissions and ministries and things like that. I don't think that there can be ideological indoctrination of children and teenagers in Brazil to the extent that she's really hoping because of the reach of technology.
I'm not so hopeful. I mean, the whole reason why Bolsonaro did get elected is because they jailed the most popular politician in the country.
Oh, we're talking Lula here?
We're talking about Lula under false pretenses. And we helped in that. And so,
We did.
As American citizens, we helped in that.
Take me through this a little bit.
Okay, so basically, Operation Car Wash was a... basically, they worked with the American Department of Justice to roll up corruption in the government. And so, as a part of that, they rolled up Lula for a corruption that is not corruption at all. It was based on the claim that he took an apartment as a gift. But the problem is that there's no paperwork tying him to it, that he never took possession of the apartment, and he was not in office when the said transaction supposedly happened. But he was arbitrarily put in prison by a judicial activist, a judge that now works for Bolsonaro.
Spinning that judicial activist kind of thing on its head. Usually in the United States, we hear judicial activist or activist judge as someone who is pushing for the rights of, you know, minority individuals or pushing for the rights of undoing things like gerrymandering. But this in this sense, you're talking about that there was a judge who really ended up taking more power than was granted to them in order to throw Lula in jail or under the bus, as it may be?
Yeah, absolutely arbitrarily applied an injustice against Lula to get rid of the most popular politician in the country, so that way the next option was Bolsonaro. And then basically he's been Lula has been locked down on in solitary confinement without access to regular media access, which is very unusual because even drug dealers get access to the media at times in the prison system in Brazil.
Really kind of interesting things to, I think, watch out for, not just from an atheistic or secularist perspective, but also in the looking at general human rights and general protections of minority peoples or marginalized individuals. It's some scary stuff that's happening there. I do want to bring it actually back to the United States, because it seems like before the government went on shutdown, there was something nice that actually happened, that there was something that all members of one of our governing bodies could actually agree on, if you can believe it. But there's some folks that are pushing back against it, because lawyers from the evangelical Christian litigation group, the Liberty Council, are lobbying congressional representatives to remove protections for LGBT individuals from an anti-lynching bill that unanimously was passed by the Senate in December. The Justice for Victims of Lynching Act would make lynching a federal crime after more than 200 legislative attempts to do so throughout the 20th century. If the bill becomes law, it would cover horrific crimes motivated by hatred of a target's actual or perceived race, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. Liberty Council leader Matt Staver likened the protections to a Trojan horse that would sneak LGBTQ protections into federal law for use in the future. Guys, this doesn't seem so bad. Oh goodness, we're actually going to have some federal recognition of protections for people based on their gender or gender identity or sexuality.
That sounds like a net positive to me. I cannot say that I am against their inclusion in the lynching bill at all. I have a hard time imagining why anybody would be opposed to that. And the idea that, oh yeah, this is a Trojan horse and we're going to use it, or they're going to use it to extend other federal protections to, well, pretty soon everybody's going to have the same rights as straight white dudes. We can't allow that.
How dare they? That's amazing. This is something that I expect Jordan Peterson to have a strong opinion about.
Oh, don't mention that name in my presence. It just breaks my heart. But it's actually kind of incredible that we got, you know, the Senate to actually agree unanimously on something. You'd think that it wouldn't be so controversial. And I'm glad that it wasn't controversial for the Senate to unanimously agree that let's actually make lynching a federal crime. Like, it's a bad thing. Let's not have a certain... a certain punishment if you lynch someone in Washington than if you do in Idaho or Oregon, right? And it seems like a natural thing to do. There's some interesting, though, implications for this kind of bill, right?
Well, if the bill goes through and lynching becomes an actual federal crime, it does actually kind of put it under the death penalty for all states, even states that don't have the death penalty. So there is that aspect to it. For people that are against the death penalty, like myself.
So if there's a moratorium on the death penalty in Washington state, but someone is lynched in Washington state, then justice for the victims of lynching might be able to say, hey, I want to try this person at the federal level. I get it. Now, another thing that actually flags me is says it's justice for victims of lynching. And for someone who has been the victim of a horrific crime, based on your target, you know, your perceived sexuality or your race or something like that. Even if that person has not been killed in the process of that act, what is justice in that sense? When you're saying, let's bring it to a federal level, is resolution to that particular thing, to the family or to the victim of that act, to that horrific act, is that trial of that person and death of that person who perpetuated that act? It kind of brings into mind what is justice for those individuals. And I think that there's a lot that can be unpacked in that particular concept. What do you think, Dan?
I think that's a really complicated idea. I mean, everybody's got a different sense of justice. I mean, somebody who is, say, a family member of a person who has been murdered one way or another, lynching or otherwise. Some people are going to say that the only way to serve justice is to kill the murderer. Some people are going to say that the only way to serve justice is to imprison the murderer. Some people are going to say, you know, exceptionally compassionate people are going to say, well, we should try to figure out why this happened, figure out what's wrong with this person and rehabilitate them if possible. That's not a common reaction, but it is a reaction I've heard from before. So when we talk about justice, I think it's such an abstract philosophical concept that it's going to vary from person to person. And I would say it makes it very difficult to decide on what is justice on a federal, state, or even, you know, county or city level.
I think one of the really neat things about the inclusion of protections for LGBT individuals is that one of the most poignant and dramatic depictions of lynching that has happened probably in the last two or three decades in the United States was the killing of Matthew Shepard. And when that happened, that was a young gay man in Wyoming who was killed horrifically. And when people looked at that and said he was killed and targeted because of his sexuality, it brought up all sorts of parallels to Black Americans that were lynched for their race. And I think that there at that time was perhaps this mutual empathy or solidarity. And one of the things is that it pains me that we have to have so present in our minds the lynching of a very photogenic, innocent looking young white boy from Wyoming that propels, even 20 years after the fact, our federal legislative body to say we should have done this for Black Americans any time over the last 125 years. And it's kind of, for me, I love the fact that we now have recognition that LGBT folks are targeted based on their perceived or actual difference in sexuality or gender identity. But it pains me that we have to have that kind of thing that then motivates us as Americans and as a legislative body to say, yes, and the whole 300 years prior where we actually did that to Black Americans, we need to have something that rectifies that. That's one of the things that it brings up for me. But in any case, this Trojan horse of letting in rights for LGBTQ people. I just want to give a little bit of a quote from Staver. That's the Liberty Council leader. And he says, it is a ways for gays to circle the wagon and they go for the juggler at some time in the future. What does he have against, jesters and clowns and people who do...
Crusty jugglers.
Yes. No, he literally said juggler.
Go for the juggler.
Go for the juggler. I think maybe we need to have a little bit of education of Matt Staver. But I don't know. We'll see where this particular thing goes. I have a hard time thinking that Congress will say, yeah, we'll do an anti-lynching bill, but we'll exclude gay folks from that or disabled folks from that. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. You can give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC or email us at questions@atheist.radio. I think that this is something that we can talk about that is unequivocally good, and that is a Saudi teen who escaped Kuwait to Thailand has been granted asylum in Canada. Thailand initially had denied entry to 18-year-old Rahaf Al-Kunun until she began tweeting that returning to her strict family would endanger her life. Al-Kunun boarded a flight to Thailand with intent to reach Australia while her family was vacationing in Kuwait. With her passport confiscated by Thai immigration authorities, Al-Kunun barricaded herself inside an airport hotel room and brought widespread media attention to her plight. Among her claims were that her family had physically and psychologically abused her, locked her in her room for half a year just for cutting her hair and refusing to wear the hijab, and had threatened to kill her for renouncing Islam. Seems like a cut and dry case, guys. I mean, I'm glad that Canada, you know, stepped forward and said, yes, you can be granted asylum here. Thailand, Kuwait, Australia. Why wasn't the U.S. stepping up and saying, we understand that locking yourself, you know, imprisoning a young woman for cutting her hair, for daring to cut her hair, and if you return, you'll be killed by your family. This is a cut and dry case. Come to the U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. is not positioned to do such a thing anymore.
Certainly, maybe not for our allies, the Saudis, right? I suppose it. You know that if you renounce your religion in Saudi Arabia, it is an offense that is punishable by death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty terrible.
So apostasy. Just saying, you know what? I was born into this religion, but not mine anymore. Nope. I'm going to cut my hair. I'm going to go against the rules of that natal religion. Oh, yeah. You're looking at maybe a death penalty. If your family itself doesn't, you know, imprison you or try and lock you away into a mental institution or engage in an honor killing or marry you off to someone. I mean, the plight of women, despite what's Donald Trump's daughter's name?
Ivanka.
Yeah, so Ivanka Trump went to, thank you for that. Ivanka Trump went to Saudi Arabia and said, oh, look, we're making great progress for women in this country. They can now drive cars.
Right. Drive cars without being able to see out their visors. I mean,
that's their metric for what's improving.
As a person who's never had to drive her own car in her life, that's probably doesn't seem quite as insignificant as it is.
I mean, this young lady who's 18 years old, we're not talking about her being able to drive her own car.
No. I'm talking about Ivanka. I don't believe she's ever had to drive her own car.
But I'm glad that Canada stepped forward for this. I mean, it seems like someone being able to step forward and say, you know what, we understand that there's individuals and there's a culture in Saudi Arabia that really threatens the freedom to not be religious. We understand that propping up women and propping up those who go against their native religion is more important in terms of freedom than whatever economic bedfellows we might have with the Saudis. And we can have our own complaints and criticisms of what Canada does for or against its own indigenous populations of peoples. But this is at least one particular good thing that Canada's done. And I think that, I mean, I would really call on the United States and call on any other country, call on Thailand for that matter. I mean, she went to Thailand first. Why wasn't Thailand willing to say, yeah, we think locking away and imprisoning a young woman for cutting her hair is the wrong thing, too?
It comes down to the fact that Saudi Arabia has a disproportionate political power and nobody wants to get on their bad side. Especially since they, even though most oil production doesn't actually come out of Saudi Arabia, they have a very high control of global oil production.
In terms of being members of OPEC, right?
Yes.
Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah, and so people don't want to be on the bad side of Saudi Arabia, which is why that nobody ever speaks out about them and the human rights. Like, they let them actually be a part of the human rights convention in the UN, which they led it like a couple years ago because they were up and... But they have terrible human rights.
So human rights where you're allowed to kill someone for going against the religion, where parents have, where a father, excuse me, has ownership over his daughter until he gets to pass on that ownership to some other man, where you're just able to just now ride a bicycle in public as a woman. Yeah, yeah. Real good human rights record.
Yeah, great.
But good on Canada for saying, hey, we're not going to be afraid to get on Saudi Arabia's bad side. We're going to welcome you into our country.
Well, considering that, I mean, they've already been kind of having a PR fight with Saudi Arabia for the last year or so. I'm not surprised at this at all.
When you're already on their bad side, just dig in and say, hey, you know what? While we're already in this situation, why don't we save a few more folks?
Actually do the right thing.
And with sort of nothing to lose, Canada being one of the largest oil producers in the world, too. So,
got to get that one in there, too. Huh. Yeah. You know what I think we just need, though? I think that all of this would be solved. All of our problems with oil, with marginalization of peoples, with drug wars, with power structures, with hierarchies, with fascism on the rise. I think we just need some peace. And you know what would really create some peace in my heart? A 33-meter statue of Jesus. Don't you guys think so?
Wait, only 33?
meters. We're talking meters now.
That doesn't sound very large.
So, a pro-life Mexican celebrity has announced plans to erect the world's tallest Jesus statue in Ciudad Victoria. Actor Eduardo Verástegui's Christ of Peace monument will reach 252 feet, a height two times that of Rio de Janeiro's Christ the Redeemer statue. Verástegui's stated goal is to leave a legacy of peace in his native state of Tamaulipas, which borders Texas and has been plagued with cartel-related violence. Beneath the statue, there will be plans to be a Catholic church, restaurants, stores, a hotel and convention center, a residential development, cable cars, and an outdoor space for artisan markets and up to 10,000 visitors. What do you guys think? Huh?
I think 252 feet is way more than 33 meters for starters.
Do some math for me. Yes, I think that you're about right. So the Christ the Redeemer statue is something like 125 feet or something like that. And that's this really big visual, right? It's like, it's in a lot of, you know, I don't know, just a lot of backgrounds and different things like that. It's very identifiable, right?
Yeah, it's like it's literally the first shot, establishing shot for anything that has to do with Brazil
or South America as a whole and things like that. But Josh, you did a little bit of background research on this. The Christ Redeemer statue isn't even like in the top 30 tallest world statues, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, honestly, to tell you the truth, it's kind of a pathetic attempt for somebody that's supposedly the greatest philosopher or basically greatest deity in the world. I mean, come on.
Right, the Buddha statues and Hindu god statues are much, much taller.
Yeah, they really are. You know, if Verástegui gets his way, this still would only come in at number 13 for tallest statues. There, it would be behind a bunch of Buddhas and a bunch of Hindu god statues and just general important individuals, culturally important individuals in a number of countries, in Japan and in India and in Thailand. And, you know, these, you have war heroes or philosophers from 1,000 years ago.
Oh, and for the record, it's about 77 meters.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, that sounds better. Now, the stated goal of this, I can't remember what state of Mexico this is, but this is a very dangerous state where basically the highest crime rates happen. And so the hope is that this statue will reduce crime. So
I guess, I mean, putting everyone to work, building a useless statue could, you know, maybe
temporarily alleviate the economy for some people. Sure. But yeah, no, the hope is that this will be something that reduces crime just magically, just because, you know, we praise our deity right here. But I wanted to actually see them put it on the border.
Right at the border. Sort of like a peace arch. I mean, we up here have an archway that you cross. There's Peace Arch Park between you know, Washington State and British Columbia. That could be a really cool gesture, but instead, no, you have to just make it your big tourist attraction.
I want it mounted perpendicular to the border so that you could climb up on one side and, and, you know, walk in to the end of the arm sticking out and just sort of drop in over the wall, you know,
do some hang gliding or some paragliding way.
Yeah, maybe even some base jumping, I don't know.
Yeah.
So
might have to be taller.
This guy's actually kind of weird. You know, I was doing a little bit of digging. He's kind of like the Mexico's Catholic version of our Kirk Cameron, right?
Right.
He was a celebrity, was a little actor, and then he sort of gained even more celebrity status when he decided to only really do religious films and things like that. He vowed celibacy in 2003. I guess he's gotten enough money to be able to hire a firm who developed Mexico City's airport, which if you look into the background of that, there's maybe some not so successful outcomes to that. But we're not really sure whether he's going to be funding this or not, or how it's going to be funded. But
at least after 15 years, he's finally erecting something.
So I think this is a challenge to Kirk Cameron. You must do better. Where's your statue of Jesus at, Kirk?
If you are Kirk Cameron and listening to this episode of Ask an Atheist, please email us and tell us, what statue will you be building? But if you're not Kirk Cameron, go ahead and find us on Facebook at Ask an Atheist WA, on Twitter at Ask an Atheist WA. We're here in Tacoma. You can give us a phone call and voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. Thank you so much, Dan and Josh, for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
You're welcome.
We'll see you guys next week.